Taxation number 211284.
Dorilfo. In those days, anything threatened British interests worldwide, the Joint Planning Staff would draw up a plan to counter this, whatever it was, appoint troops to handle it, and then would appoint a commander-in-chief somewhere, the most convenient place, to command the operation. And then the Joint Intelligence Staff and the Foreign Office would draw up what they called indicators, which was a list of things that that country would have to do if they were to carry out this threat, whatever it might be. For example, in those days, if they wanted to get their railway flats all in one position and move their tanks, and this sort of thing. And they'd have to take certain financial actions, which people would know. And this is where cocktail parties came in. We got more information from cocktail parties, I believe, in those days, than anywhere else. And also the businessmen in those days used to hand the embassy a lot of information. Anyway, this is the way things happened. And one Friday night, the Chief of Staff Secretariat, we had a Major General as full secretary, a four ringer as deputy, and there were three desks. One Friday evening, about 7:30, I was the last one left in the office. And the permanent undersecretary from the Foreign Office walked across Charles Street into the Ministry of Defence and came to our office and said, "Good evening, Bob. All the indicators are down on Kuwait." And I did a double take because, I don't know about you, but I had never ordered a war. So I confirmed to him that meant that we'd have to order an operation, which we knew of, called Vantage. And he said, "Yes, we would." And off he went. Well, there I was entirely on my toes. The Prime Minister, I knew, was either grass shooting or something up in the moors. This was Macmillan. The Chairman and Chief of Staff, Mountbatten, was in this Fastnet race, I think, or one of those things. The Principal Secretary had gone away on a golfing weekend. I was on the top. So I sent for my number two to come back in. He was a naval 2.5. And I then got down to it. I rang the War Office, first of all, and said who I was. I managed to get hold of the most resistant to the CIGS, which was as good a person I could get, and told him who I was. He knew who I was. And that all the indicators were down that we'd ordering Operation Vantage. He said, "Okay, Bob, he'd take you on the army side." I then rang the Admiralty and got hold of the duty commander, told him who I was, and I said, "You do have a safe there with a key of top secret things in it." He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, get a folder out called Vantage," which he did. And I said, "Open it in the front page, do what it says." That was all right. I left it to him. In those days, the Air Force had its own operations then. They were actually in the Air Ministry, which handled all the nuclear stuff. This was 1960, remember. And so I knew that would be most efficient of all. So I rang up the operation room there, got hold of the duty squadron leader, and said who I was. He was to implement Operation Vantage at once, and I was very helpful. I told him there were two more operations, which I named. He had all at the same time. He adjusted at once and rang off. So I sat down, had a gin, and wondered what the hell I did next. I sent a signal officer, Aidan, by the way, which was the place which the Commander-in-Chief Aidan had been appointed to command this operation. And so I sent a flash signal to him saying that the operation was on. I sat down, had a gin. By the time I finished my gin, my number two had come in. So the two of us were sitting there on our top, with no one else around. I then had a phone call from this bright squadron leader in the Air Ministry. He said, "It was an exercise, though, wasn't it?" So I read in his future and told him it wasn't an exercise. I said, you better get me the assistant chief of air staff operations on the phone at once. He says, I can't, sir. He says, cocktail party. I think, had I had blood pressure, that might have been the end of me. However, I pointed out that if I didn't have Akazops on the phone to me inside half an hour, I would court-martial him personally. So this seemed to work, and I got Akazops on, and I told him what happened, and he said, OK, and the Air Force was in control. So we sat back and had another gin. Then things started to go wrong. A signal came in, flash signal from Aden. Flash was the fastest priority there was. A flash signal was the fastest thing there was. And we had a signal back from Aden saying, sorry about this, old boy, but we changed the whole plan last week, and you haven't got a copy in the United Kingdom yet. Now, at that time, television wasn't in existence. But you could transmit a printed word so that you sent off from one end and it came up on the screen at the other end. But we had this available in the Ministry of Defence, so we set it up in the old war room that Churchill used to use during the war. And we started collecting all of the long carriage typewriters, you know, long things like this, because I don't know if you've ever seen an operational order, but they are vast things just to allow for all the loading of ships and the offloading, so everything arrives in the right order and the right way. And we sent out drivers, all the drivers we could get hold of, to pick up all of the security cleared types we could find in London. Now, remember, this was some 10 o'clock Friday night. And people aren't very happy. I know one of the girls came in an evening dress that night. Anyway, we managed to get enough of them, and we sat them all down in old Churchill's war room, and they typed out this operation so that it was in the hands of everyone who needed it by 9 o'clock the next morning. Macmillan, Prime Minister, had come back into his office by then. But he was the only one who had come back. And the situation was that we had all the forces we needed, at least the majority of the forces we needed for the operation, were all based in Cyprus. The Airborne Division, for example, and people like that, they were all based in Cyprus. The heavy equipment for the operation was at Aden, which had to be flown from Aden across to Kuwait. And the situation was that we said to Turkey, we wished to go over Turkey, and they said that you couldn't, because they were scared of what Russia would do. We'd had a punch-up with Israel, so they wouldn't let us go anywhere. We weren't even talking with Israel those days. We'd just had the Egyptian operation, so no way were the Egyptians going to be prepared to let us fly over. And no way were the Libyans. We discovered the gap in the radar down the border between Egypt and Libya. So we got on to the cabinet secretariat. I said, get the blessing for us to go down there. And they did. And then Sudan stepped in and said, it's okay for you to overfly, but you mustn't be in uniform. So all the chaps did was took off their jackets. So they went down the shirt sleeves with guns on their knees. They wanted uniform. And these are the troops that had to go down there to operate the heavy equipment which we then had to fly from Aden into Saudi, into Kuwait. And the Saudis came up and said they wouldn't let us ever fly there. And no way could we get around, right way around. Well, there was a thing in those days called the Red Green Net, which was where planners at a high enough level could talk to each other worldwide, of the major powers only. Their idea was that planners would use this net to prevent their bosses dropping a clanger. And it was very useful, as you can imagine. And we used this net to get onto Israel, first of all, because we had a team. Three aircraft, three Hastings, remember the old Hastings, in Nicosia, who had to we got into Kuwait to so that the other people could get in. It was electronic gear with them. And had to be got in to let everything else operate properly. So we got used the red-green net to get on Israel and said, "Oh, look, you need Hussein in Kuwait about as much as we do. And we need to go over there with three Hastings." They said, "Hold it, we'll come back to you." And I came back in 20 minutes, it was all brilliant. I said, "We've got a certain radar station off the air between midnight and 2 a.m. Is that all right?" We said, "Lovely." It didn't go off the air at all, did it? But three Hastings flew over Israel without letter of hindrance, straight into Kuwait that night. I know it's very true, this story, because I gave this talk some years later to Headquarters Strike Command out of Gessenheim. And after dinner, the command navigation officer came up to me and said, "I was the navigator in the leading Hastings that night." So I'd know it happened. And then Saudi came up and said we couldn't overfly Saudi, and we had to. Now, there's only one radar station in Saudi Arabia, that was at Riyadh, and it was manned by Americans. So we got on to the Americans and said, "Well, look, we've got to get in there. And you're not going to see us, are you?" They said, "No, we've gone deaf." So we flew straight over Saudi that night. With Americans, not say a blind word. And we still hadn't got the airborne division in there. And this was worrying us. So the Prime Minister got cracking and he put almighty amount of pressure onto the Turkish Prime Minister. Eventually we had a message back. This man, the ambassador, contacted him and got the direct word from him, he would okay it on the quiet. He then went into hiding, didn't he? He finished up at something like the Colombian Embassy or something like that. But anyway, our bloke tracked him down and found him and went up to him in the middle of this party. He said, "Sir, do I have your permission to overfly?" And after much mucking about, the Turkish Prime Minister said, "Okay." Our ambassador looked at his watch and said, "Next year, sir, I must inform you our fifth aircraft has just entered your airspace." That was the end of that operation. And that's the end of my story, really.
When did your RAF career finally finish?
I retired eventually, prematurely. I was bored with it, bored to tears. So I applied for early retirement and I came out in 1966.
What would you say was the highlight?
Of what?
Of your whole career.
I don't think there was one. I enjoyed it all.